Should get water. I'm good.
Are you okay?
Yeah, you seem like stressed and like.
I kind of am. I'm like really warm. Oh. Well, okay. One, two, no clapping. I'm just counting off myself.
Oh, okay. You confused me. I was taking a drink, so I was like, I can't clap right now.
This is the best start we've ever had, I think.
Yeah. This should be entertaining.
Welcome to another episode of Jabber on the Drone, the movie review podcast that politely disagrees to agree. From Portland, Oregon, you are Richard Wally.
And from Garden Grove, California, you are Cassidy Robinson.
Yes. As opposed to Garden Grove, Sweden.
Yes. Yes.
Yeah.
I don't want to confuse anybody.
No.
Well, you have to say Portland, Oregon, because people will say Portland, Maine.
I don't know exactly why I announce where we're from. I guess I just want people to appreciate the effort that goes into doing this long distance.
Oh, okay.
And maybe it makes us sound a little bit more like continental or transnational or something. I don't know.
I don't think so, since we're both on the West Coast. It's like 10 hours away. It's really not that far. I mean, driving time 10 hours away.
But we have a wider perspective. Like a 1,200 mile perspective. Something like that.
Okay.
What have you been doing? What's up with your life?
You know, I do nothing. And then on the weekends, I party, you know.
Party, as I've heard.
Yeah. No. Yeah. I just went up to a friend's cabin this weekend. It was a lot of fun.
Oh, yeah. This was your cabin in the woods weekend.
Yeah. Yeah. No, we...
I saw the Facebook pictures of you, like creeping in the woods, like looking real pensively through the foliage.
Oh yeah, that was just
in your big goofy hat.
In my big goofy hat, yeah. It's a comfy.
You know, I have a picture of me in a very similar goofy hat.
On the beach?
No, that's a different goofy hat picture.
Oh.
No, this was one that Cade took of me when we were Christmas shopping. It's the same type of like big Russian looking hat.
Yeah, they're pretty goofy looking.
Yeah.
No, so
you didn't get murdered?
No, we did play Murder in the Dark.
Yeah?
Yeah, and they were super drunk, so, well, not, they weren't super drunk, actually. Maybe one or two of them were fairly wasted, but they were taking shots right in between games, so that was kind of amusing to turn the lights off right after people have taken shots, but, you know.
So they give themselves away?
Not really. One of our friends was really, really good at killing everybody, and it was kind of,
creepy.
It was a little creepy. It was a little like, please, man, I think there might be something wrong with you. Maybe no.
It's the same as like, it's like the same rules as like the werewolf game, right? That we played over at Chris and Hillary's forever ago.
Yes, except there's a physical aspect to it.
You have to actually kill people. That's the
difference. You turn off the lights. And you wander around in the dark, and then somebody puts their finger, like they draw a line across your throat with their finger.
Mm-hmm.
And that means you're dead. And then somebody else has to find the body, or the serial killer announces, oh, you know, I found a body, and everybody comes together, and then you debate who killed them.
Yeah, but then you have to, like, if you are one of the killers, you have to lie, and...
Yeah.
And like that type of thing.
Yeah.
Yeah. I ended up being really good at that.
Well, yeah, because you're also a serial killer, really. This was just like secondhand for you.
Yeah. It was practical experience I had in lying and covering up for being a serial killer.
Yeah.
So.
See, everybody
not
just,
fair, really.
I never get the picked players. As the killer, and I'm always really disappointed. And but I'm like the first one everybody wants to kill. They're like, "You definitely killed everybody," and I'm like, "Okay, I see how this is."
But you just have that look.
I just have that look, just that you kill people look, I guess.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know. I'm debating whether or not after this I should go to the gym. Because I signed up.
Have you to, gone?
I did. I was good for like a week. And then I've been bad for like 2 weeks.
Just got to put yourself in a routine, buddy.
Yeah, I was. I did. And then school started, and I was like, school started. That's my excuse. And now I'm just like, I really need to go because that's $10 a month that's being drawn from my account.
I feel really weird about this conversation.
Why?
You move to California, you get an iPhone, and you start going to the gym. What the fuck?
Uh-huh.
You next sell week, out.
Next week, I'm going to bleach my tips.
I thought you were going to say your anus. That's apparently a California thing.
We'll see. That might be more like a fourth or fifth step.
Oh, okay. Okay.
Yeah. All right. Well, let's go ahead and get into our movie news on that note. And I'll let you start. What do you have for us?
Well, it is news to me that anal bleaching goes straight into movie news on that note. Well, why don't we start it off with, so there's supposedly this new Gotham series that's like predates before Batman's and actually is in Gotham, and kind of gives you some of the setup and kind of what happened there, I guess.
Uh-huh.
But they just announced, they had some casting announcements, and specifically they have Robin Lord Taylor will be playing Oswald Cobblepot.
AKA the Penguin.
Yes, in the future. He might not have a monocle yet. You don't know that.
Perfect vision. We'll see, like, in the first episode, someone's going to, like, jab him in the eye, and it'll be part of his character arc.
Or maybe he's tall. Maybe they cut him in half.
Maybe he's really skinny.
We'll see. No, the other one that I actually did kind of somewhat know is Alfred Pennyworth. They just cast him, and it's Sean Pertwee.
Mm-hmm.
We were just talking about he's in a lot of Neil Marshall movies like Doomsday and Dog Soldiers and stuff like that.
Yeah.
I believe he plays in Doomsday, he plays he plays the main scientist of the ones they send out to research and stuff like that. So.
Okay. What channel is this premiering on again? Is this Fox?
I think it's NBC.
Really?
Isn't that weird? Like, that doesn't seem right, does it?
I mean, I'm sure it's a property they are glad to be a part of. And it kind of makes sense. Isn't CBS doing the Marvel show?
Well, no, ABC is doing
this. ABC, another one of their main competitors.
Disney, yeah, but that's a Disney affiliate.
Yeah, so is NBC a WB affiliate? Because that's Universal.
Because they have the WB.
Yeah.
So.
It is weird. I'm not sure where the paper trail is on all of that. But Alfred's going to be in it. So we can assume that Bruce Wayne in some, or maybe it's the years he's away in China training. Like, how is that going to work?
I think it's supposed to be a much younger Bruce Wayne, like kid after the murder.
Smallville for.
Yes.
Yeah, okay. For Batman.
Well, I mean, some of those characters do have some interesting stories. I mean, I know if Jim Gordon, I think Jim Gordon's supposed to be part of it.
Mm-hmm. I know he is. I think we even talked about that.
Yeah, no, Harvey Bullock got cast. He's the guy from, like, Terriers and, I forgot his name, redheaded fellow.
Yeah, the one who was in Grounded for Life, that TV series, and he was also in the Blade movies.
Yeah, well, the Blade, yeah, the first one. Yeah. Kind of ugly, but a great, great actor. So... No, yeah. I really
no. I think he's good, and he makes sense for Harvey Bullock. Yeah,
yeah. So I don't know. I mean, it sounds like it could be cool, and they did kind of like a Gotham Central kind of like vibe. Yeah. That would be a, that'd be fun, but I don't know what they're doing.
I don't either.
It's to me, everything surrounding this is sort of bizarre. I'm just like, okay.
It's probably going to be like CSI Gotham, but maybe campier. I'm not sure.
I guess we'll see.
My first news item, which blew up our Facebook page when I posted this somehow. Greta Gerwig, actress, mainly known for her roles in Noah Baumbach's Greenberg and Frances Ha, as well as the Arthur remake and a few other movies. She has just decided to step out of the world of indie cred into television to do a spin-off version of How I Met Your Mother, starring as the main character of How I Met Your Dad.
It's probably father, isn't it? Because that sounds silly. How I Met Your Dad.
No, that's what it says here in the article. So hopefully that's not the going
They title, should say How I Met Your Father.
It rings better in it my just, ears.
It sounds better. Yeah, that How I Met Your Dad sounds stupid. I guess it kind of makes sense. Like, if I guess if
is she like was, a girl Ted Mosby to you? Do you get that vibe?
I could see that, yeah.
Is she an every girl?
Sort of, yeah.
Yeah, she's kind of girl next door-ish. And, I mean, honestly, depending on the writing, depending on... I hope... Because How I Met Your Mother, which just barely finished, is kind of the last of a certain kind of sitcom style with the three-camera laugh track style.
Right.
I hope that this show decides to do away with that, and it's only in concept the same, but stylistically could be very different.
Yeah.
Because I feel like if it was a three-camera sitcom, she would just feel really, I don't know, constipated in the role and not really allowed to do what she does, which is, you know, very naturalistic, quirky, kind of awkward humor.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I think that that has kind of some quirky, like everything you mentioned, the How I Met Your Mother did at one point. I thought it really sucked its last few seasons, but its first few seasons I thought were great and did have that quality to it, and they just unfortunately had their laugh track.
But it was still a very much written style sitcom where it's, you know, set up joke, the dialogue banter is very fast.
I think she could do that. I don't know if I'd want to watch. I don't know if I'd be down. I know you would be, but I don't think I'd be down for a Greenberg show or a Frances Ha show. An hour and a half is enough. I don't need eight to nine seasons of that.
I'd be into it, but I mean, basically, it's just going to be a show about this chick dating, right? Like that's what How I Met Your Mother was about.
Well, yeah, and I'm sure they want to. I mean, this seems like one of those shows that's like trying to get on like Girls and that kind of. I don't know.
Or just replace
How I Met Your Mother, which has been a huge hit for them.
Yeah, and it's a money machine that nobody wants to be involved with anymore. So this is going to be like their Saved by the Bell, the new class.
Yeah, pretty much.
And it'll probably last just as long, or like Baywatch Nights.
Right.
So I don't have a lot of high hopes in it as a project, but I do like Greta Gerwig a lot. Hopefully they write it towards her sensibility rather than trying to force her into something that she's not comfortable doing. We'll see.
Well, like I said, I was a How I Met Your Mother fan, and the last couple seasons have been. It's weird because the sentimentality has like that part of the show has maintained fairly constant. But the humor in the show the last couple of years has gotten really, really stupid.
Yeah.
And kind of cheesy, and I don't know, like, I don't know well, if that's everybody what happens just gave with, up, but...
That's what seems to happen with sitcoms. Unless it's, like, a really bizarre show in concept, like Third Rock from the Sun.
Right.
But even with, like, a naturalistic show like Friends or How I Met Your Mother or just, like, shows about regular people...
Mm-hmm.
It's usually like funny-ish, and then by like season 8 they become manic, insane, crazy people that don't act like human beings.
Right.
because they're always trying to up the ante, and then it, you know, at least that's been the trend. We'll see if that happens here.
Yeah, we'll see.
Okay, what's your next story?
Talking about mannequin crazy trends and well, a mannequin crazy character. So Michael Keaton recently announced that from as far as he can tell, is there's going to be another Beetlejuice. And he said of any character in anything he's ever done, that's the only thing he's ever wanted to do a sequel of. So So this Beetlejuice 2 news is apparently really percolating and probably coming to fruition.
Mm-hmm. Is it going to be Tim Burton still?
Apparently, yes.
And what else is he doing?
Michael Keaton said Tim has really been talking about it and really wants to do it. And if he does it, I'm definitely in. That was basically what the article came to. Also, apparently Winona Ryder might be back, which is kind of interesting.
Exactly. What else has she done?
I don't know. Might as well, right?
Yeah. At this point, all of the people involved, Tim Burton notwithstanding, need it, honestly. Although Michael Keaton is having a slow comeback. Like, he's popping up more and more, which makes me happy because I really like him.
Agreed.
I don't need this. I don't think any of us do. It's not necessarily, I think, the right step in any of those people's directions. Especially Tim Burton, who really is on the cusp of either making it or breaking it lately. With the right script, of course, anything can be fine.
Yeah, I was just about
to... I'm skeptical, but...
I completely agree with you. I was going to play the devil's advocate a little bit. And I mean, specifically with this, I think this is maybe... It's my favorite Tim Burton property. I think it has... Honestly, it has the most ability to have a sequel of any of
Yeah, because they, you know, the first one, they had built this enormous mythology and world.
Yeah.
And allude to so much that you don't see.
And it does kind of feel like there could be more to it. And I mean, the first one, kind of seeing it to it, it feels like there's like some really interesting, weird satire going on in it.
Mm-hmm.
And, I mean, so if he kind of goes back to doing that kind of stuff, which even I felt like Dark Shadows did that for like the first like third of the movie.
It tried, yeah.
I thought the first third of that film was successful. It was the last two thirds that
less so.
Yeah,
yeah.
Well, it got into this weird love stuff, and that didn't work at all. And then the third part, just we don't need to talk about that because people are fucking werewolves and stuff, apparently. this one to me, if he is going to go back to his body of work, to me, Beetlejuice is strong enough. I don't think you can ruin Beetlejuice.
So even if it's a terrible sequel, Beetlejuice will live on.
It's been on its own for so long that this will be one of those mini movies that are like, oh, went back to it. That was a bad decision. Da-dum-dum.
Yeah. Or like Crystal Skulls, the Kingdom of the Crystal Skulls.
Yeah, that like, kind of...
It didn't diminish the original Indiana Jones trilogy.
Well, there was enough of a break between them, you know? If this was a year and then he made a really shitty movie, that'd be different, but...
Yeah.
But it's been, what, like 25? Almost 30, maybe?
Yeah, I would say 87. So, yeah, about 27 years.
Yeah.
Which is pretty crazy.
Yeah, that's what would, I guess, it. Be kind of weird about having Lydia come back. I guess you could do her kids.
Well, it makes sense because she never died.
Yeah.
In the first movie, so she would age, but you couldn't really have Alec Baldwin and Gina Davis's characters because they look so different now.
Yeah, that's true.
So it would actually make more sense with Lydia. I wonder if it'd be like the really bizarre cartoon. Do you remember the Saturday morning cartoon
Beetlejuice? Yeah, I loved it.
But it was nothing like the movie. Like they'd go to friends and he's basically like her like genie who just hangs out with her at school and stuff and gets her into trouble, even though like in the movie he's like actively trying to kill everybody.
Yeah. Well, they go to Beetlejuice Land a lot. You know what I'm saying? Well, it was also created by Tim Burton, too, so I have no idea where they're going to go with it. So, I mean, to me, it's I don't know. His next movie that he's doing about two painters, the Big Eyes, I forgot what the artist's name is, but he paints these people with big eyes. But everybody found out later that it was his wife that was actually the painter. That's his next movie. And that's actually kind of interesting that he's going
that kind of more to kind of a biopic, yeah. Something a little bit more sedated.
Maybe even Ed Woody, you know.
Yeah, that would be cool.
Yeah, so. So we'll see. That's all I can say at this point. I do tend to agree with you, though. okay. I guess we'll be seeing it, I suppose. Yeah.
So, it's my turn for the pet topic.
Mm-hmm.
And I was trying to, I had a few things in mind, but we've been doing like kind of really talky, theoretical stuff for a while. So I kind of want to loosen it up and just do something kind of dumb and listy.
Sounds good.
And I was thinking about, both the new version of RoboCop and the old version. Paul Verhoeven's very well known for a lot of really graphic, gross out moments, specifically the scene where the guy gets like covered and radiated goo and then turns into a giant cancer mutant and then gets hit by a car. And I was thinking of just like gross out scenes in general, like what scenes really viscerally grossed us out. So I don't know, what about you?
I mean just kind of going on Verhoeven again too. RoboCop, his first film, I remember very vividly the hand being blown off from when I was a kid.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it definitely, I mean, the thing about this kind of stuff is it should be used, like, to a reason. Anyway, getting back to the list, though. No, one of the more recent ones was in Antichrist. I mean, that's an easy one to go to, but that one gross. It may have ruined that movie for me so much. So, there's a certain part where
Lars von Trier, film, yeah.
It's the part where she gives him the really uncomfortable circumcision scene.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not a circumcision; it's more like a bolt through his penis. Or no, it's through his leg. But then she like bangs his cock with a wooden log or something, and like it's. Sprays blood. It's a Lars von Trier at his highest
most end
of trying to assault you through film.
Yeah, yes, yes.
I felt assaulted.
It's a shocking movie on a lot of levels, especially the last third. And it, you know, it's a really slow burn getting there.
Yeah.
And then it really just pulls out all the stops. But it's fair enough. So that one made you cross your legs? That one really grossed you out?
I probably would have liked the movie a lot more if it just wasn't for whatever that whole thing was about. I know you've had conversation. We've tried to talk about it, but I just...
It's one that I feel I need to see again. I feel like that movie, you can't judge critically on a first viewing based upon how it is. I've heard a lot of people say very smart things about it.
I feel like the subtext, like a lot of the subtext I've heard and we've talked about and stuff like that, I feel like does exist. But that scene alone, I just feel like, to me, it's almost still like too assaulting and too much. Like, I don't think it, I think there is a way to do that without being...
Over the edge.
Well, without making you want to, like, you know, push your TV on the floor and, like, jump on it.
So did that really gross you out, or did that just, like, disturb you or just offend you?
All of it.
Or all of the above?
Just all, yeah.
All of it. All right, the first one I have here on my list is the spitting scene from Todd Haynes' Poison, which in and of itself, the film is not that graphic or gross. But it was this scene in particular has kind of been held up as, like, a really intense moment for a lot of people to watch, and it was called out a lot at the time as being a controversial moment, where there's a scene where this prisoner gets singled out by the other prisoners, and to shame him for carrying on another relationship with another prisoner. They make him stand out in a field while they all hawk into the air with his, and he has to keep his mouth open and catch it. And it goes on for a while.
Hmm.
And it's there's something about that idea that really turns my stomach. Like, I can't watch it. Like, and it's, you know, I've seen a lot of really messed up shit, and in the grand scheme of things, that's not that bad, but there's just something about that that's, like, really, really gross to me.
And I have to look away. I mean, hawking loogies in people's throats? Yeah, that's pretty gross. I don't think that's just you.
But I mean, in context of, like, you know, like, all of the crazy, like, somebody pulling out somebody's intestine and then hanging him with it or whatever, and then, like, you know, if you've ever kissed a person, you're ingesting their saliva, but it's just the visual is really...
It's different.
Nasty.
It's,
yeah, no.
It's a lot different.
All right, what's your other ones?
For this one, I actually want you to plug your ears, because one day I want you to watch this film.
Okay. I'll remove my headphones, I guess. And I'll give you 15 seconds on it.
Okay, well, I'll do like a whole introduction and everything, and then you can just cut out this discussion completely. Okay, so my next film is a Noé film. What's his first name? I can't remember.
Jasper.
Jasper Noé. So the movie is Enter the Void. There's a scene close to the end where you kind of get this weird out-of-body experience where a penis enters into a vagina and then jizzes all over you as the viewer. I was pretty fucking grossed out by that. I'm not going to lie.
All right. I didn't listen to that, so that will still shock me when and if I see that movie. Is it another... I mean, just a heads up. Is it another, like, Antichrist... like, crazy violent thing?
No, not crazy violent at all.
It's not like the fire hydrant thing from Irreversible?
No. Actually, Enter the Void is, like, it doesn't really have any visceral violent moments, I don't think. It's actually, I mean, for the most part, it's a fairly, like, neon lights kind of movie. It's just kind of weird. It was my first Jasper Noé movie, and I was like, I don't. And to be honest, his kind of filmmaking sometimes is just kind of like, okay, I guess, to me. I don't know. I guess I'm not... it's just a little too much. But specifically, this one just had a moment close to the end where it just... I was just got like, this is too much. It's just too much. And it's just kind of the point of view that you're getting. It's just not, it's not cool.
Fair enough. My second one, this goes back far, but I still think it'd have to be high on my list, is the vomit on a theme park ride scene from Problem Child 2. I don't know if you ever saw those movies.
I did. I don't remember the second one other than there's the little girl in it. I don't remember much from that one, though. I saw the first one a lot.
I think I may have seen the second one more, but yeah, that's a basic gist, is there is a girl who's, like, competing against him over who's worse. But there's a scene very similar to the scene that's in The Sandlot, where they vomit on, I think, probably the same ride, like a kind of a Tilt-A-Whirl type ride, or magic carpet or whatever. And the girl is, like, trying to get back at him. Or no, he's trying to get back at her. I don't remember. You know, they're doing their spy versus spy the whole movie, and she speeds up the ride to go way faster than it's supposed to, and just everyone starts vomiting. But it's, like, the consistency and the look of the vomit. Like, in Sandlot, it's, like, brown goo because they were chewing tobacco. But in this, it's, like, this... It looks really thick and creamy and kind of like oatmeal. And it's just, like, the worst vomit consistency you can ever see. And there's a lot more of it. Like, it gets obscene how much vomit there is, because everyone, like, watching starts vomiting.
Right.
And it's probably one of the grossest vomit scenes I can think of in a movie, period.
Yeah,
It's built up in my head, and I should see it again and be like, oh, that was nothing. But yeah. I remember that really, really I would fast forward through that part.
I don't remember it. I know I saw that one once or twice. I always caught the problem child movies like on TV. I think we had it on recorded VHS at one point, but I don't know. I don't remember that at all. I feel like I should, but
maybe you blocked it out.
Yeah, maybe it's a little
from trauma.
Antichrist.
Yeah. What's your next one?
My next one is I actually really like this film as opposed to the last two I've mentioned. David Cronenberg's Naked Lunch.
Okay.
But there's a scene close to, I think it's like 3/4 in. Where he goes into this house and there's like this weird bird cage monster humping gay sex thing. And it's not the gay, it's just the aesthetic. It has nothing to do with the gay sex. It has nothing to do with anything except for David Cronenberg's aesthetic in that scene.
And no, I remember the scene. It's like his hustler boy or whatever turns, like, morphs into this creepy, weird, glistening puppet, and it's like having sex with something.
Yeah,
it's a weird visual. It's hard to even describe.
It's in a bird cage too, and it's just like he enters in. Yeah, it's
and it like has centipede legs and
yeah.
There's about 5 or 6 of those kind of scenes in that movie.
Yeah, that's the one that was, like, burned into the back of my head, though. Like, that's the one I specifically remember. I'm always like, I guess I have a slight fear of just, like, opening up a door and that just seeing that and just going, and close the door immediately. Like, oh, shit.
Yeah. That's a crazy movie.
Yeah.
I mean, I just watched that and I let it wash over me because I can't process it any other way.
No,
it's a collection of crazy ass visuals.
Kind of, yeah. I don't know. I kind of enjoyed it, but at the same time, yeah, it's.
No, in a lot of ways, it's his most like interesting and like the way he like tries to visualize the beat poet's drugged out aesthetic is kind of interesting, but it's a really weird movie.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's saying something from David Cronenberg. The last one I have here on my list is not surprising probably to anybody who's seen it. Salo and the 120 Days of Sodom. It's written in the style of the Marquis de Sade, but also the Dante's Inferno. So at one point in the movie, the Italian fascists who are torturing these teenagers for the whole movie, we enter into this segment of the film subtitled The Circle of Shit, where basically for a 20-minute segment of the movie, they're making these kids eat feces in lots of different ways. And it might be the most difficult part of that movie, but that's a kind of a toss-up depending on your sensibilities. But it's pretty hard to watch. Even though you know it's fake and you know it's a movie, it's just incessant and it goes on for a while in lots of different ways.
That's gross. I don't have anything to comment towards that. It's just fucking gross, man. I don't...
Yeah.
Ugh.
I think that's one of the things from that movie that's still, even by, you know, 1978 or 77 when it was made, to today's standards, that's still like a high watermark for shock moments in film, art film, mainstream or otherwise.
Right.
Yeah. So there's that.
Okay. Cool.
Those are the moments that grossed us out the most.
I've got two more if you want.
I think we're going to have to cut it there.
Okay, sounds good.
We're creeping on 40. So I saw, now for something completely different. I saw the Lego Movie this weekend. And I was initially kind of apprehensive to see it because I thought that, oh, this is just, you know, an obvious toy tie-in thing like the Battleship movie or Transformers where they're just trying to sell more toys and, you know, they could throw in all of these pop culture references because Lego owns everything. And so I just thought it was going to, this movie was just going to be really dumb and I was pretty much ready to skip it. But then for the coming weeks before and after it came out, I was hearing almost nothing but positive things about it, and, you know, without really researching it. And I thought, well, what's going on here? And I looked into the production, and it come to find out that it was directed by Phil Lord and Chris Miller, the guys who wrote Cloudy with a Chance of Meatballs and 21 Jump Street.
Mm-hmm.
And so I thought, okay, you know, that actually, had I known that, maybe I would have. So, what this movie's about. It's not about a lot, but basically, you have this main character named Blake, and he's a regular average dude in the LEGO universe. You know, he's not a special LEGO dude, he's just a construction worker pawn, you know, one of the regular yellow faced kind. And he lives in a very constructed, regulated world where they have an evil overlord called President Business, and voiced by Will Ferrell. And one day, in the middle of his normal everyday, going to work every day and regulated life, he sees this freedom fighter girl, who's voiced by Elizabeth Banks, named Wildstyle, who has crazy colored hair, and she can build things amazingly fast. So he somehow gets tied up in some prophecy that where he is going to take down the system, and he may or may not be actually part of the prophecy, or could have been all just a misunderstanding. So plot-wise, it's taking a little bit from movies like Brazil, actually kind of a lot from movies like Brazil and The Matrix. But because it's Chris Miller and Phil Lord, they have this amazing talent of, I don't even know how you would really describe it. Their sensibility is not dissimilar to, the Mystery Science 3000 guys. Like, except for instead of standing outside of the movie making fun of it, they make fun of their own movies within the movie. And they know, they point out multiple times throughout the movie, just as they did in 21 Jump Street, that this is a dumb idea. And this is a very commercial and exploitative idea. But if we're here, we're going to make sure you're having fun. And that's sort of their talent. That's very unique to them. And it's amazing how they keep getting work, and keep having this enormous success with these movies that are, you know, funny and entertaining, and they do all the things that they're supposed to do, but they're also really, really subversive, if you think about it. Especially, you know, calling out in the movie that this is a bullshit idea. And it's, I had a lot of fun with the movie. It's very fast. It's very quick dialogue. It's one of those movies you could see more than once because there's so many jokes being thrown at you at any given time, whether they be visual jokes or jokes in the dialogue or, you know, just little details that you could probably catch new things all the time. And there's a lot of fun details within the actual LEGO universe. Like, there's a character, voiced by Charlie Day, who's one of those old spaceman from like the 80s. And he's wearing one of those helmets that, you know, like caps over their head perfectly. But at the bottom ridge at his chin is cracked in the middle. And I thought that was like so clever because that's what always happens to those ones. And just little details like that that are really interesting and really fun. And I'm not going to come right out here and call it a masterpiece. I think that as a piece of storytelling, it's kind of sloppy. There's some stuff in there where the plot is kind of more subservient to the jokes, and there's a lot of stuff where it feels there's a lot of scenes that kind of meander, and there's a lot of places in it where it feels like it's making itself up as it goes, but it's so funny and it's so fast that it never, you never get caught up in all of its flaws. So I recommend the Lego Movie. I actually think it's really fun, and the animation itself, there is definitely a lot of computer being used, but it almost, a lot of it appears to be stop motion using actual Lego pieces. So if you're into stop motion animation in general, this is a really great example of how it can be used in a modern sense. And it's one of the more creative animated films I've seen in a really long time, as well as, you know, being funny. And there's going to, you know, obviously there's going to be a lot of easy visual gags and stuff like that for the kids, but there's, you know, a kind of a more subversive, satirical stuff going on there for the adults. Especially if you like Cloudy with a Chance of Meatballs and 21 Jump Street.
Well, I saw some of the names involved, and yeah, it's kind of like, okay, well, it's easy to get names involved when you give them money, but but I also saw that it was these guys, and I said, beforehand, I was like, this could be okay, we'll see, and so I'm glad you liked it. I'll definitely check it out at some point.
Cool. So. Well, let's go ahead and go on into the RoboCop remake, which is a movie we've been talking about a lot since its inception, and I'll let you set it up.
Okay. Yeah, so this is the remake of RoboCop, and it is directed by Jose Padilla.
Uh-huh.
He's a Brazilian director. He's done a lot of actionier kind of like cop movies, so...
kind of makes sense.
It kind of makes sense. I haven't seen them, but they have a general kind of good reputation, so... That was always kind of interesting about it. Also, the first thing I saw when I saw some of the cast, I was really interested in it. But the film is... What?
Who in particular stood out for you, cast-wise?
Well, when you first saw Samuel L. Jackson, Michael Keaton, and Gary Oldman, I was like, oh,
yeah,
those are a lot of people I like, and they can be interesting, so we'll see. Like, usually if you have one of them, of any one of them, I would have been like, I don't think so. Because that would be like, okay, I definitely did that one for the money, or, you know, have fun, or whatever they're doing at that time. But you usually don't see them all three in a film together, kind of, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah, I got you.
That's kind of what, kind of was like, okay, that's kind of a positive. And then Joel Kinnaman, I know that I've only heard good things about The Killing, so...
Mm-hmm.
So I thought, okay, there might be something here. And then I started seeing the previews, and I was like, this is going to be shitty. What's funny, though, is you had the opposite reaction. Like, later, you're like, no, I'm kind of down. And I'm like, no, it's, it still doesn't look good. But so I finally get around to it. And it's RoboCop. The thing is it is RoboCop, but it doesn't tell the same story again.
Mm-hmm.
It has the same character, you know, of Alex Murphy. He's in a, you know, corrupt police force, and it kind of tells a story about that. But what it does differently is kind of how it edits and juxtapositions the story. Also, mm-hmm. the story has a lot more to do with Omnicorp and what's going on with their science and business, as much as it does with Alex Murphy.
Yeah.
So basically, the other thing is you see him die and you see him get rebuilt. But what you have different from the original one is you have these him juxtapositioned with his family.
Yeah.
Now, this film for me during my theater experience was very satisfying.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not going to say that it was like, you know, this great remastering, revision, beautiful, blah, blah, blah. But the movie actually had a lot going for it. For a remake, it didn't just hit all the same notes and try to just rehash. I felt like some of the subtext in it was really pretty smart, just going mm-hmm. with the whole drone thing, and going with technology and how business. And I mean, it really did weave in a lot of different, like, little kind of interesting subtext. Also, it just was kind of a straight-up Frankenstein story. And there's a moment, and I think this is why you went with the grossest question as well. But no, yeah. I actually, this moment in the movie really stands out and is really fucking great. They strip away everything, like RoboCop's whole body, and they just have this...
the organic stuff.
And they just
out.
Have what's left of him as a human and what makes him function still as a human. And it's actually, it's kind of weird because it gives you this moment of what is humanity, kind of.
Yeah.
Because we are entering a strange, new, brave new world, kind of, in a way, because how is robotics and cybernetics and all this shit going to affect us? Mm-hmm. What is necessary? What is the human experience? So it kind of did a lot of that. I kind of felt like it undercut itself at the end a little bit as a film. It just kind of became actionier. And I mean, it was still kind of satisfying, but not... It just didn't have the same flavor. It kind of just seemed like a big scene where he fought some dudes. But
a set piece.
Yeah, but as a remake in general, I actually think this is fairly successful because it gives you what you want, but it also kind of reworks the story and doesn't give you just the same beat-for-beat story.
Yeah.
I actually really liked most of... I liked all the acting. At first, I was really worried because I thought that they weren't going... I thought they were just going to give you the very basic, like, kind of like, oh, this is Alex Murphy and this is his family. But then when they started cutting it in and out and his family became a part of it, like, I thought that they were just going to glaze over that. And they didn't. And so it's kind of... It's a really weird because you have these memories of the old RoboCop, this visceral, dirty, gritty... thing.
Your Verhoeven stuff.
Yeah, your Verhoeven identity, you know.
His idiosyncratic take on this kind of material.
Yeah, and then you have this PG-13, which is, it's a little slicker, it's not as, it's not nearly as a scary of a world in a lot of ways, but I still feel like it, it kind of, I feel like as a movie, it at least stands on its own, so I do have to give it some merit. Mm-hmm. But like I said, I think it cuts itself a little bit at the end. It's sometimes a little lackluster. There's just something kind of missing from it. But in general, I don't know. I the acting stuff that I really liked, I did really like this weird Samuel L. Jackson bookends and middle notes and all these kind of things.
Well, he's kind of a Greek chorus.
He's kind of a Greek chorus, and also, to me, there was kind of a weird subtext there where it was kind of like about the media.
Yeah.
So...
kind of about the 24-hour propagandistic news.
Yeah, correct. Yeah.
Also,
Michael Keaton and Gary Oldman. I liked all three of them a lot in this film. Yeah.
I kind of love this movie.
Good.
And I feel really sort of like... I don't know, like, usually I'm on the side to really be against these remakes. And I feel like in the coming weeks, I'm really going to end up defending this movie a lot. Because I feel like people don't want to like it. I actually see very little wrong with it.
I actually feel like there's more... Yeah, no, I more or less agree with you, except for my little caveats that I've already added. But I feel like the actual backlash to this film is more to remakes and less to this actual film.
Yeah, it's on the idea of it being remade in the first place, which is fine. But, no, I walked into this thing expecting the worst, and maybe that had something to do with it, but I really enjoyed it from pretty much from the beginning to the end. I felt like it was a little slow to get going, you know, introducing the character. He's kind of this, you know, undercover detective, and he's like, you know, going in on this stuff with a black scent, and it's kind of like, okay, this is definitely different, but I can get into this maybe. And it felt a little bit like the first third kind of felt like the pilot to a new rebooted RoboCop series.
Mm-hmm.
And then once they start bringing it to Omnicorp and they're building him and they're training him, I was really impressed with pretty much everything. I think the storytelling is actually really good. It's a story, you know, in a classic sense, which most movies nowadays that are blockbusters or action sci-fi based forget to be a story. They're just an excuse to hang set pieces. And this movie, I never felt like it was rushing to get to the next set piece. I felt like it was always character oriented.
Mm-hmm.
And it always had interesting ideas and things to explore, whether it be talking about the media, and the 24-hour, propaganda, or whether it's talking about the future of drone technology in a war scenario or in, on home ground, or whether it be talking about even, you know, more broad philosophical ideas like what is free will.
Mm-hmm.
I thought this movie was like, top to bottom, pretty good. I was never bored. I felt like the set pieces were integrated in a storytelling way, not just there to happen. And, like, the super climax, which every movie needs one, is not... I actually think this movie is actually kind of intimate. And it's more to do with him trying to... You know, I guess, like, probably closest comparison I can really think of as a story is maybe Alex Proyas's The Crow.
Well, if they
do... In that everything he's doing is for... his character.
Yeah.
And I thought that was an interesting way to tell the story, to keep it within the city. And
if they wouldn't have ended it on the roof like they did, yeah, in that more intimate, like, just pared down action scene, you wouldn't be right, because the scene where he's fighting like 30 of the walkers, like, that one for me, that was a little like, and it, to me, it got into this weird territory of I'm usually not the one saying this, so I feel very strange. It got into a little bit of CGI land. See, this is my...
But one... I thought that actually the movie, like, considering that it's a big effects-heavy movie,
yeah,
I was never taken out by bad CGI. I felt like a lot of the action had weight to it, and, like...
I thought for the most
there was a physicality
to
it. I mean, yeah, that's the biggest moment of the movie, but I didn't feel like that was a poorly done scene or unearned.
I don't think it was poorly done. I just felt like at times there wasn't weight to it, and there was something kind of weird and bizarre, and kind of almost it took me out because they didn't do many moments like that. And I don't think they should have necessarily. It just, there's something about that scene kind of took me out. The other problem that I'm still trying to kind of place, mm-hmm, is the fact that when I watched the movie, I had a pretty pleasant time and I liked it. But it's been when I've sat on it for a while. I've kind of just, it hasn't...
It's faded.
It's a just little. Faded a bit. Like, if we would have got with me, like, right after I'd watched it, I would have probably given a little bit more positive of a review. But mm-hmm, since I've sat on it for a little bit, I'm like, it's kind of just fading. And I mean, I agree with you pretty much completely. It's pretty... something else that I kind of, like, dug, but which was kind of weird, is they still really do the really robotic noises when he moves.
Yeah.
And there's this scene where he's running away. That they actually, what was, I thought, kind of clever in a weird sort of silly small moment, is that they build up his speed like a locomotive,
mm-hmm,
when he's running out this door. So it's not like his first, like, few steps are really slow, and that's like, and yeah. I really, that was just some, like, little weird thing that he did right as a filmmaker. But no, like, what I thought he did the most right is this is what people should look at for a good remake.
Yeah, he really reworked the story in a new way. It doesn't feel like it's just going beat per beat. And, you know, it is PG-13. It isn't as gruesome as the Verhoeven version. But I almost think this should have been R. It would be a light R, sure. But there is a huge body count in this movie for a PG-13. And there's blunt violence. I mean, whether it may not, like,
be as
gory. But, I mean, you know, he's flat out just shooting people in the head all throughout this movie.
I see what you're saying.
The violence that is,
I just see implicated. Right now, as soon as you said that, I was like, I would honestly say that Dark Knight was probably, and that was a soft R in a lot of ways.
I think that is a soft R. And actually, Dark Knight, there is a lot of post-Dark Knight vibe to this movie.
Yeah, but it didn't go so dark and visceral gritty, which I kind of actually... That was actually a plus to the film.
No, this movie does have a sense of humor, too. Jackie Earle Haley is in here, and who's really good in this movie. Maybe the best I've seen him since Little Children. And he's really funny, and he gets a lot to do, and it's a really chewy performance. And I just feel like he handles the ensemble really well. I'm really surprised that this is not being as... not being embraced stronger than it is, because I think this is pretty damn good. It's about as good as we can really ask for a remake we didn't want made in the first place.
No, I can agree with that, and I can definitely agree. And like I said, for me too, I was actually less... Like, I liked the Alex Murphy, and I thought Joel Kinnaman did a good job, and Abby Cornish, and the whole family did really good.
But actually, she's my only thing that I'm not way into. I think she's kind of blah. But
she was the weakest link, I will say that.
Yeah.
But I was actually way more into, for some reason, for me, the movie was more about Gary Oldman and Michael Keaton and kind of their weird relationship. Yeah. And for me, that's actually what the film is about. I don't think it was about RoboCop at all.
Well, RoboCop is used... And that's the stuff I
enjoyed.
Yeah, and this was kind of the same in the first one, too, because, you know, Peter Weller as RoboCop is not really the standout performance of that movie because he's in a robot suit the whole time. And I think that Kinnaman gets a little bit more character work in this movie than Weller did. But
I
think that, you know, in both as a movies...
Character...
Yeah,
was more like the set piece, the star, you know. Yeah. Where in this one, I actually kind of think that there's a really big subplot going on with Michael Keaton and Gary Oldman.
Yeah,
and it's and honestly, again, I want to say there's a scene where Michael Keaton gets to be Michael Keaton. I haven't seen that in so long that I was like. I like giggled and pointed at the screen almost. Where
he's really great in this, and you know, you get Gary Oldman and Michael Keaton kind of switching roles because you know, if this was 1989, they would kind of be the other way around.
That's true.
And I think that you know, Jay Baruchel plays this real weaselly marketing guy, and there's a lot of like fun satire in that too.
Mm-hmm.
RoboCop, I think in this movie. Maybe more so than the first one, is more of a cipher to explore all these other sci-fi ideas.
Agreed.
And just social political ideas in general.
Well, you kind of. But
I don't
think
that's a bad thing.
Well, I almost got kind of a vibe like people coming back from war, you know.
Yeah.
Body parts missing kind of thing.
Well, it's a little bit more of a parable this time around.
Agreed.
But I really enjoyed it. I mean, I haven't had this much fun at, like, a quote-unquote dumb blockbuster in a long-ass time.
Well, Blockbuster Remake put that on... Because that does add something to it.
Certainly, yeah. So I way recommend it.
I recommend it. I don't way recommend it. I just recommend it. I said... Well, like I said, there's something for me that kind of... that with time, it became a little lackluster to me, and I don't know what it is about it specifically.
Yeah, I mean, I'll check in next week and see if I've changed my opinion on it. But I do actually. I want to rewatch the original because it's been a few years before I write my official review.
Mm-hmm.
Because sometimes I'll forget certain plot details and so I don't know how similar or dissimilar it is. But I it feels pretty different to me.
No, I feel like it's a whole nother story. I really do, and I feel like it's like I said, it's its own movie.
It's certainly better than RoboCop 2 or 3.
Well, yeah, I mean, there's some things to be said about 2 that I'm way into, and the third one just gets into fucking ridiculous land, so I almost enjoy it for that, you know, ninja fucking robot bullshit, but...
Jetpacks and...
Yeah, just gets really ridiculous in the third one, but I really like the villain in the second one, so...
More so than anything, I was impressed by the storytelling. It's like, thank you for writing a fucking story.
Well, yeah. Like, and not rehashing the original one.
Well, and having a natural character arc and letting scenes breathe and develop and letting us kind of get a sense of place and just stuff that movies, like basic filmmaking things that movies have forgotten how to do.
I can agree.
All right. Well, going into our next sci-fi film, since this is sci-fi month, the Netflix homework that I had you do is Dreamscape, 1984, starring Dennis Quaid, Max von Sydow, and who's the other old guy? Christopher Plummer.
There you go.
Which you would think... if Max von Sydow and Christopher Plummer are ever in a movie together, then the universe would just implode. There are another two that for some reason in my head I always get them mixed up. But
I can see that one.
Well, more so now than then, but because they're both like your go-to old guys to play stuff in movies now. But the reason I had you look at this is because I'd heard back when Inception came out in 2011, 2010, whatever it was, it was being referenced a lot. A lot of people were like, oh, there's this old movie called Dreamscape and some of those ideas, blah, 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 blah. And basically what we have here is a story of a ex-psychic turned gambler who's sort of on the run, who gets picked up by this corporation that's secretly working for the government to learn how to enter other people's dreams and possibly use that power to help people or to assassinate people or whatever. And, you know, Dennis Quaid's just kind of trying to learn the trade, as it were, and maybe finds out more than he's supposed to know. What did you think of Dreamscape?
It's definitely in the body of, like, 80s kind of action, silly, sci-fi, just fun.
Yeah, it's schlocky. You can say it.
Well, I think it's 80s schlock, though, and that has a specific...
quality, yeah.
It has a specific taste, almost. So it's almost more palpable in a lot of ways. Like, I enjoyed Dennis Quaid. I thought that he was kind of that weird 80s plucky hero. Like, sidekick, blah, you know, kind of Bill Paxton-y kind of thing. But, and for the most part, I don't know, I had a lot of fun. Some of the stuff was, it got a little bit like, some of the storyline was definitely tacked on. But for the most part, it was kind of fun. I would say if you're specifically... I wouldn't. Some of the ideas I think you could compare to Inception, but don't link those two movies too much, because if you do in your mind, you're not going to get the same experience.
No, I mean, Inception is a very different kind of movie. Actually, this movie did remind me of a lot of other movies.
Yeah,
but not necessarily so much Inception. And actually, the movies that it reminded me of the most was The 13th Floor.
Okay,
which we watched last year. As well as, this came out the same year as the first, Nightmare on Elm Street, which uses a similar conceits. And there was something else that was a lot more obvious, but I'm forgetting what it was now.
You have...
The Cell.
Oh. Well, your whole thing is a lot better than mine. I was thinking the sci-fi comedy adventure version. That happened, like, if Scanners, like the David Cronenberg movie, ran into a comedy action sci-fi kind of fun thing in the middle and then turned into an Inception in the future. That's what I was thinking the whole time.
It has a very... There is a Scanners/Firestarter vibe to the movie.
Yeah.
With this whole government conspiracy stuff and, like, them trying to, like... And that's actually my least favorite stuff in this movie. I feel like it has a really interesting setup, and it has a really interesting device, but then it decides, for me, unfortunately, the second half of the movie decides to go to the least interesting aspects of the story, which is just becomes a kind of a political thriller about, you know, a government assassination attempt and how he has to stop it, and it just...
Oh, yeah.
And there's this ridiculous scene that goes on way too long with him just being chased on a motorcycle. It's like, what movie is this now?
And no, it got pretty contrived there. Well, you know, somebody's trying to kill the president. I mean, you don't get much. I mean, those kind of scenes can be fine, but it was...
I just feel like the movie had more potential to do smarter things than that. Like, there was this whole thing in the beginning of the movie about this boy whose dreams were so intense that it was killing the people who are trying to enter, and I thought, ooh, I thought that was going to be more the story.
Mm-hmm.
And then it ends, they kind of resolve that, and it becomes this, I don't know, less interesting version of, like, a kind of Stephen King-ish, Dead Zone-y Firestarter type thing.
Yeah, no, I agree. It did become, it was just really, again, really contrived piece of let's save the president kind of
thing.
I mean, it was a little... I mean, there was almost, they almost decided to go for some subtext, but then just kind of threw it away. Mm-hmm. I will say that his dream was, the president, like, their kind of set piece was kind of cool. I mean,
yeah, at the end,
compared to, like, CG standard, but there was kind of a, like, a palpability, like a real, like you could really, like, feel the environment.
Yeah, because it's a real set. There's no CG. I mean, even the special effects, there's a lot of go motion in this, and it looks like go motion, but even that has a physicality.
Yeah, and so I was, like, I was just talking kind of like the blown-up, like, Washington, D.C. in the background, that kind of stuff. I did kind of like that about the ending, but yeah, it's kind of a mixed bag of a movie. However, if you're just kind of looking for a good time, and kind of a plucky 80s adventure,
it's
lighthearted sci-fi with a little bit of a dark tone, I guess, note to it.
It has kind of a horror inflection sometimes. I mean, certainly some of the dreams, specifically the boy's dream in the middle of the movie, has kind of a German expressionist design, which is sort of cool.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think it ultimately dates weird. It's not great, but it's interesting to see in context of all the films I feel like must have influenced by it. Mm-hmm. You know, not just Inception, but all those other ones I was talking about, like 13th Floor and The Cell and all those others.
Well, I think it does have, like you said, some of the better stuff that we've talked about definitely does have some kind of quality to it that does kind of stick with you.
But
it's just kind of some of its wrappings, like the president thing and
some
of the weird 80s quirks and schlock is kind of silly. But other than that, if this is something that you're into, I could see people get kind of actually digging this film. I kind of dug it.
Yeah, I wouldn't say it's a bad movie per se. It's just sort of an artifact of its time.
Yeah.
So what do you have for me next week?
Next week we're gonna dip into some fanboyish territory, some Trek territory, with Star Trek First Contact.
Yes, which is on my list of shame. I know it's everyone's favorite Star Trek movie, but I've never seen it.
Well, it's their favorite New Generation Star Trek movie.
Yeah. And it's always the one, back when I used to tell people that I didn't really care for Star Trek, this was always the one they told me, well, you should see this before you say that.
Mm-hmm.
Even though now I've kind of come around to the old Star Trek movies, I think are a lot of fun. But, all right, cool. And that's what we'll do next week. And then anything we talk about in this segment, I don't say enough, both Dreamscape and Star Trek First Contact, you can watch on Netflix Instant Streaming. If you have anything to say to us, whether it be comments about the films we reviewed this week or what we're going to be talking about next week, or any general comments you have about the show, you can get in contact to us at jabberinthedrone@gmail.com. You can also contact us or follow us on Facebook at facebook.com/jabberpodcast, where we post our news items as well as anything you need to know about updates about the show. You can also subscribe to us on iTunes or find our RSS feed at jabberinthedrone.podbean.com. We are also on Stitcher Radio and Pocket Cast, so you can listen to us on your favorite mobile device. You can read my movie reviews that I do every week for the Idaho State Journal at saladforkreviews.blogspot.com, as well as the content I provide for the Seattle-based website, The MacGuffin, at mcguff.in/author. And Richard has a blog now, and you can follow him at rdwolley, rdwolley, dot weebly, weebly.com. Well, since this is new for you, having an online presence of any kind,
mm-hmm.
why don't you tell our listening audience what they can expect to find there, what type of stuff you're going to be doing.
Well, basically, I mean, the first homepage is just kind of a little blurb, but then it's kind of showing, I'm trying to get some of my writing kind of component stuff that I do in my other part of my life. I'm trying to give a place that can be seen. And then I have something for the podcast, of course. And then I'm also, the thing that he was talking about, the blog component of the website, is actually a place where I'm going to start to try to put a review of something once a month. It might not, the first one will be a movie, about a movie, but then after that, I'll probably dip into some graphic novels. It could be books, it could be food, it could be whatever, you know. It could be how I feel about the transit system, whatever, you know. I might review whatever.
Sure.
Those will come at you about once a month. But yeah, that's pretty much what it is for now. You can also find some other people that I'm linked to, like Cassidy and some of the artists I've been working with or such. But it should be expanding as I go on. So
cool deal. And I'll link on this episode on our both on our Facebook and on our homepage at Podbean. I'll put a link so that people can find it.
Okay, thank you.
And until then, we'll talk to you next week.
Okay, see you.
Bye.